Whoop, something's not right. There we go. Now it's right. There's your timeline of the Bible, and I think you all have seen this before. How many of you have seen this? Raise your hand if you've seen this. Raise your hand if you've never seen this before. Okay. Okay. So that's not surprising, but I would hope that everybody who's regular here has seen this before, because I've used it a number of times. And so this shaded area here is the period of time during which the Old Testament books of the Bible were written. Moses is the first writer of the Old Testament. Of course, he's the one who leads the Israelites out of Egypt. And we come all the way down to the period of the captivity, and then after the captivity, there are several prophets. You have Zechariah and Haggai, and you have Ezra and Nehemiah written in this period of time. And then, of course, Malachi. New Testament books are written in this period of time, after the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. And now, when we talk about what these books talk about, though, the Old Testament describes events that were written before the time of Moses. So that takes us all the way back to the beginning of time, of creation. And the New Testament looks backwards and tells us of the life of Jesus, and then beyond his death, and the early years of the spread of the gospel before any of the actual New Testament books were written. So what does that leave? Well, that leaves that little blank space there that is often referred to as the 400 years of silence, or the 400 years of biblical silence. Has anybody ever heard that expression? Okay. But guess what? It's not silence. The Bible, there were no books written during that period of time, no books of the Bible. There were books written, and we'll talk about a couple tonight. We'll mention briefly 1st and 2nd Maccabees. These are works that do not claim to be inspired, did not claim to be inspired, were not regarded as inspired, but they did describe the history of events written by Jews and describe the history of events during that period of time. But the Bible itself is not silent with respect to those years. Daniel, you'll remember, lives in this period of time. He lived before the captivity. He was one of the young men who was carried away by Nebuchadnezzar in 605 to be trained for service in Nebuchadnezzar's court. Then he lived all through the captivity in Babylon. And then after the captivity came to a conclusion, he continued to be an important man in the Persian, in the administration of the Persian king who had defeated the Babylonians. So let's look at what Daniel says about these 400 years. Because while the Bible does not have books written during that period of time, Daniel looks forward to it and tells us what's going to happen in that period of time. For instance, in Daniel chapter 2, there's the dream that Nebuchadnezzar has in which he sees a statue, an image, and this has four parts: a head of gold, breasts of silver, loins of bronze, legs of iron with clay mixed in the feet. And Daniel interprets that dream for Nebuchadnezzar, who dreamed about that thing. He tells him that the head of gold is him, the king of Babylon, or Babylon. And then after that, you're going to have another part that would be represented by the breast of silver. That would be the Medo-Persian Empire. And then another part that would be represented by the bronze trunk, which would be Greece. And then the legs with clay made of iron and with clay mixed in with feet would be the Roman Empire. Now, we are not told in chapter 2 that this represents the Medo-Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, and the Roman Empire. We are told, however, that it represents the successive kingdoms after Babylon. And from history, we know that these are they. And they fill in that period of time. Scott, I've got something in my throat. Could you get me a cup of water, please? I'll come to Daniel chapter 7. And Daniel has a vision in which he sees four beasts: the lion, the bear, the leopard, and then a fourth one, different than the others. And there's enough reason to see peril. Thank you. You got to join me in a drink, maybe? There's enough difference to see the parallel to realize that Daniel 7 is talking about the same thing as Daniel chapter 2. And so these are the same four kingdoms that are being foreseen by Daniel. In Daniel 8, there's an interesting chapter in which we get a focus on the Medo-Persian Empire and the Greek Empire, these two that would follow the Babylonian Empire. At this time, Daniel is already now, the Persians are already in power, and Daniel is serving in the Persian Empire. But in the vision that we see in Daniel 8, there is described a ram, and I have it down there next to Susa, which would be the capital city of Persia. And this ram is described as having two horns, one longer than the other. And as a matter of fact, the longer one came up last. And so what that would represent would be the two parts of the Persian Empire, made up of Media and Persia, and the older being Media, but Persia eclipsed it. And so we often just refer to the Persian Empire instead of the Medo-Persian Empire. So two horns, one longer, you've got the one short one, and the one longer comes up second. This ram is described as spreading out to the west and to the north and to the south. And the Persians did during this period of time. They advanced in all these directions. And then there is described a goat that comes from the west, and it moves quickly across the ground, and it attacks this ram, and they go head to head. And the goat prevails. If you'll look at Daniel chapter 8 in your Bible, you'll see that the guesswork is taken out of things for us. Because in Daniel chapter 8, verse 20, we are explicitly told, the ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. And then down in verse 21, the shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn that is between his eyes is its first king. And the broken horn and the four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms, which will arise from his nation, although not with his power. So, the conspicuous horn, as it's described earlier in the chapter, is going to represent Alexander the Great, who conquers the world for Greece. And then that horn is broken. Alexander died young, replaced by four horns. And we'll talk more about what that means in a moment, but basically it's his successors, who are not his descendants, but some of his generals that take over the kingdom, divided up amongst themselves. And then there arises a small horn on this goat that is going to represent Antiochus Epiphanes, whom we'll talk about in a few minutes. So, then we come to Daniel chapter 10, and in Daniel chapter 10, there is an angelic being who appears to Daniel, and he says to him, down here in this time after captivity, he says to him, I have come to give you an understanding of what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision pertains to the days yet future. And then this discussion continues into chapter 11, and this being tells Daniel what's going to happen. And it's in chapter 11 that we read this, what's going to happen in that so-called 400 years of silence. Now, so far what we've talked about is Daniel's description of these great world empires, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. And that's kind of big picture. And we're not surprised at that, really. There are a lot of prophecies in the Old Testament that tell us things like this. But the next part is a little bit unusual. As we get into chapter 11, and this angelic being is telling Daniel what is going to happen, the things pertaining to days yet future, in chapter 11, he's going to talk especially about Greece, a little bit about Medo-Persia, and then about Greece in considerable detail. And the degree of the detail, the level of detail that he describes what's going to happen is quite impressive. And I'll come back to that in a few moments. But let's just go right into it and see what he describes. In Daniel chapter 11, verse 2, he said, now I'll tell you the truth. Three more kings will rise for Persia. So we're going to get into the details now. Those three more kings would be Cambyses, probably Pseudo-Smyrnus, and Darius Hystaspes. And then it goes on in Daniel 11, 2, it says, a fourth king will be unusually rich, more so than all who preceded him. When he has amassed power through his riches, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece, and that would be Xerxes. Xerxes is also known as Ahasuerus in the Bible. At least most people think that that's who those two names go together, and I do. And that's the man who is in the book of Esther. And Esther becomes his wife. And he does. He advances all the way over through Turkey and even into Greece and has wars with the Greeks over there as he spreads his empire. Verse 3 says, then a powerful king will arise, exercising great authority and doing as he pleases. And we've already seen this referred to in Daniel chapter 8, but this is going to be Alexander the Great, who's going to arise. He's a Macedonian. He's going to be the king of the Greeks or king of Greece. And he is going to conquer the world. He's going to head from the regions around the Mediterranean Sea down into Egypt, naming, or every place where he goes getting named Alexandria, head through Babylon, another Alexandria, down into this region, more Alexandrias, and an Alexandropolis, comes around here, for some place, reason that place gets named Hydaspes, I don't know why, and everything else is Alexandria. And then he comes back around and gets back to about Babylon, and he dies at a fairly young age, in his early 30s. And so very quickly, he's that goat that's described in Daniel 8 as moving quickly across the land and conquering. And then verse 4 says, did I get that? Yes. Verse 4 says of Daniel 11, shortly after his rise to power, he died young. Shortly after his rise to power, his kingdom will be broken up. Normally, when a king of a great empire dies, his son becomes king after him. But not in this case. His kingdom will be broken up and distributed toward the four winds of the sky, but not to his posterity, or with the authority he exercised. For his kingdom will be uprooted and distributed to others besides these, besides his posterity. And so these are some of the generals that got different chunks of his empire after his death. I want you to notice down there in Egypt, the king of the south, Ptolemy the First, Soter. Soter means savior. And a lot of the kings that are going to reign in Egypt are going to be of this line of Ptolemy. They're going to be called Ptolemy so and so, Ptolemy so and so. In Daniel the 11th chapter, the term king of the south is used for this whole line of kings, starting with Ptolemy the First, Soter. But the text goes on in Daniel the 11th verse 5. It says, then the king of the south and one of his subordinates will grow strong. His subordinate will resist him, and he will rule a kingdom greater than his. Well, that subordinate is probably Seleucus the First Nicator. And he is going to be the beginning of a line of kings that are going to be referred to as the king of the north. And they're going to start out controlling Syria up here. But he's going to grow strong and rule a kingdom greater than even the Ptolemies down in the south. And so we're going to focus here for the rest of our time as we go through this on the king of the south, who will be the Ptolemies, and the king of the north, which will be the successors to Seleucus I and Nicator. And in the south, Ptolemy the First Soter is succeeded by his son, Ptolemy the Second Philadelphus. Notice that we're moving forward in time now. We're down to 285 B.C., and he is king from 285 B.C. to 246. And in the north, Seleucus is succeeded by his son, Antiochus Soter. Notice again, Soter means savior. And then he is succeeded by his son, Antiochus the Second, Theos. You notice these names, Antiochus, now. You recognize that right there, lower left-hand corner, is Antioch, Antiochus. That's not an accident. And Antioch, of course, is a city from which Paul and Barnabas will travel in Acts 13th chapter. Antiochus II, Theos, by the way, Theos means God. So they thought highly of themselves. Antiochus II, Theos, had a wife named Laodice. Does that remind anyone of anything? Laodicea. And there's a reason. He controlled that region of Turkey, and Laodicea is right over here. You can't see the word Laodicea, but it would be that dot right there. And he established Laodicea and named it for his wife. And that's the reason those two look so familiar. They had a baby named Seleucus II Callinicus. It's always a good name for a cute little bitty chubby baby. Seleucus II Callinicus. Down in the south, the king of the south, Ptolemy II Philadelphus, had a daughter named Berenice. Daniel the 11th chapter verse 6 says, after some years have passed, they will form an alliance. The king of the north and the king of the south will form an alliance. And how did you often form alliances? Kings form alliances in ancient times. Well, you swapped a woman. You married a daughter or married a sister or something like that. And so the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north to make an agreement. So
He's already got a wife. He's got to send her away. So Laodicea and baby Seleucus II Callinicus get sent away. And Berenice comes up, the daughter of the king of the south, will come to the king of the north. And that will secure this alliance between these two kings. Then Berenice has a baby, baby Antiochus. Continuing in the text in Daniel, the 11th chapter, we read the part where it said, after some years have passed, they'll form an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north to make an agreement. We read that much. But she, Berenice, will not retain her power, nor will he continue in his strength. She, together with the one who brought her, her child, and her benefactor, will all be delivered over at that time. What happened was, in 246 B.C., the king of the south died, the one that was the father of Berenice, the one that had made this deal with the king of the north. And he's replaced by his son, Ptolemy III Euergetes, who happens to be the brother of Berenice then. And, well, the father of Berenice having died, Antiochus II Theas figures, well, he can't hold me to that deal anymore. I want to go back to Laodicea. So he does go back to Laodicea and abandons Berenice. Sometime not long after that, he was poisoned to death, and most people think that Laodicea did it. Apparently she wasn't the forgiving type. And then she had Berenice murdered, and she had baby Antiochus murdered. So it says in Daniel the 11th chapter, verse 7, there will arise in his place one from her family line who will come from Berenice's family line, who will come against their army and will enter the stronghold of the king of the north and will move against them successfully. And so Euergetes, who is the brother of Berenice and doesn't like the way she was treated, particularly the part where she got killed, he comes up and he starts taking this territory in Syria that had belonged to the Seleucids. And the text goes on and says, he will also take their gods into captivity to Egypt, along with their cast images and prized utensils of silver and gold, and he will withdraw from some years from the king of the north. And so what happened was, he captured Laodicea and killed her. Then Seleucus II falls off his horse and gets killed. Then he is succeeded by his son Seleucus III Soter, again means savior, and he is assassinated, succeeded by his brother Antiochus III the Great. Ptolemy Euergetes is headed back down to Egypt. Down here in the south, Euergetes dies, and he's replaced by his son Ptolemy IV Philopater. Daniel 11:9 says the king of the north will advance against the empire of the king of the south, but will withdraw to his own land. His sons will wage war, mustering a large army, which will advance like an overflowing river and carry the battle all the way to the enemy's fortress. Antiochus III comes down and starts retaking territory. He gets Syria back. He comes down as far as a place called Raphia in 217 B.C. And there's a great battle at Raphia. And Antiochus comes to that battle with a lot of forces. But in chapter 11, verse 11, it says the king of the south will be enraged and will march out to fight against the king of the north, who will also muster a large army. So here comes Philopater, and he had elephants. He had African elephants on his side. But Antiochus had Asian elephants on his side. Who knows which are bigger?
African.
Asian. The Indian elephants. The great big old elephants. And so he comes with the great big ones. And the historians, I'm not talking about modern historians, I'm talking about the ancient historians, going back to Polybius and Livy and these guys, they say that the African elephants were terrified by the smell and the sight of these large Asian elephants. And so that Antiochus's elephants routed from to Antiochus' right, which I understand would be closer to the Mediterranean Sea, routed the African elephants, and it looked like Antiochus was going to win, and he thought he was going to win. But the elephants were not decisive. Instead, Ptolemy ends up winning, and so you'll see down there in Daniel 11, chapter verse 11, that army, the army of the king of the north, would be delivered into his hand. And so he stops the advance of the king of the north. The king of the north only gets this far coming toward Egypt.
Philopater dies. His son, Ptolemy V, Epiphanes, becomes king now. And he is just a child at this time. Something like 4 years old. And he becomes king. So obviously he's got handlers who are running things behind the scenes. Daniel 11 verse 15 says, "Then the king of the north will advance and will build siege mounds and capture a well-fortified city." This probably refers to the Battle of Panium. I'm not sure how to say that. It takes place 200 B.C. We're moving closer and closer to New Testament times here. "The forces of the south will not prevail, not even his finest contingents." So Ptolemy, his forces, they do not prevail this time. Antiochus gets the better of it. "They will have no strength to prevail." Verse 16 says, "The one advancing against him will do as he pleases, and no one will be able to stand for him." And it's because he had cataphracts. That's different than cataracts. Cataphracts are these horses that are fully armored with soldiers on them that are fully armored like that. And the historians, the ancient historians, say these were decisive in this battle. And then it says, "He will prevail in the beautiful land," an expression you may recognize as being a description of Israel. "He'll prevail in the beautiful land, and its annihilation will be within his power." Then in 193, something happens. Chapter 11, verse 17 in Daniel. "His intention will be to come with the strength of his entire kingdom, and he'll form alliances. He will give the king of the south a daughter." So he's going to end up striking an alliance with the king of the south, just like happened a few generations earlier. And he'll give the king of the south a daughter in marriage in order to destroy the kingdom. He's got kind of a devious plan in mind here. But it will not turn out to his advantage. So his daughter is Cleopatra, and she is 10 years old. Remember, Ptolemy V was 4 years old when he became king. Now he's about 16. And so Cleopatra comes down and becomes the wife of Ptolemy V, Epiphanes, down in Egypt. And they form this alliance. Verse 18 of Daniel says, "He will turn his attention to the coastal regions and will capture many of them." The coastal regions is an expression in the Old Testament that generally refers to all of this area here and maybe over toward Italy. So you've got Cyprus along the coast here, Greece, and Italy. So it says he'll turn his attention to the coastal regions and will capture many of them, but a commander will bring his shameful conduct to a halt. In addition, he will make him pay for his shameful conduct. So here goes Antiochus to the coastal regions. And Rome is becoming a power by this time. And they want to put a stop to this. And so a Roman commander named Scipio Asiaticus comes out. And they do battle down here not too far from Ephesus. And Scipio Asiaticus wins that battle and sends Antiochus packing. And so Antiochus heads back home. And then he heads over off to Persia, and he dies in Persia. His son, Seleucus IV, Philopater, becomes the king of the north now. And Daniel 11, verse 20 says, "There will rise after him one who will send out an exactor of tribute to enhance the splendor of the kingdom. But after a few days, he'll be destroyed, though not in anger or battle." So Seleucus IV, Philopater, sends out an exactor. Heliodorus is the name of the man whom he sends to the temple in Jerusalem, having heard that the temple is full of riches. And he goes down there and raids the temple, takes it all, requires it as tribute, and brings it back. And this is all described in 2 Maccabees chapter 3 sometime, if you want to look that up and read about that. Described from a historical point of view. Daniel is describing it prospectively, looking forward to these events. The king of the south dies, and his wife Cleopatra now rules on behalf of their son, Ptolemy the sixth, Philometer. And then in 176, Ptolemy the sixth, Philometer, after Cleopatra's death, he actually now becomes the ruler, not just in name, but in actuality in Egypt. Daniel 11, verse 21 says, "In his place a despicable person will rise, on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred." We're back in the north now. "He will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue." It's not Heliodorus, but remember Heliodorus? He's going to come into view here in just a moment.
The king of the north, Seleucus IV Philopater, has a brother named Mithridates and an infant son named Antiochus. And that Heliodorus that we read talked about a moment ago, who came down and took the treasure out of the temple, he assassinates Philopater and sets himself up to be his successor. But Philopater's brother is not happy about that. Mithridates, he comes over and runs Heliodorus out of there. There he is. And then he says, hey, I'll be co-regent with my nephew. Because after all, Antiochus is just an infant, and you can't have an infant be king. You can have a four-year-old be king, but you can't have an infant be king. And so Mithridates says, I'll be co-regent with him. But what actually happens is, after a little bit, he kills Antiochus and sets himself up and takes the name Antiochus IV Epiphanes, the appearing one. This is the Antiochus Epiphanes that's represented by the little horn back in Daniel the 8th chapter. Daniel the 11th chapter, and verse 22, it says, the overflowing forces will be flooded away before him. Oh, we skipped one thing I want to go back and make sure you catch. It said he would come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. That's probably referring to this, where he's going to, I'm just going to be co-regent with my nephew. He's not the rightful heir to the throne. The nephew is, but he has the nephew killed and he becomes king. Then Daniel chapter 11, verse 22, the overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. After an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception. He will go up and gain power with a small force of people. In a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm, and he'll accomplish what his fathers never did. There's been this tension between the king of the north and the king of the south all this time, but the king of the north really never brought the king of the south into submission, into subjection, never really took over in the south. Well, this guy, he's going to accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He'll distribute plunder, booty, and possessions among them, and he will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time. So Antiochus does. He comes down to Memphis and then heads up to Alexandria, and he makes Ptolemy Philometer his servant. Ptolemy is going to be his puppet king now. And so now Antiochus IV Epiphanes is in control of everything. And he heads back up this way. Then the people in Egypt say, well, wait a minute. We want not Philometer to be king. We want his brother Euergetes to be king. So Ptolemy the 8th, Euergetes, becomes king as a co-regent with Philometer. So those two brothers are ruling together in Egypt, but Antiochus is still really kind of in charge. Daniel 11, verse 29, at the appointed time, he will return, come into the south. But this last time, it will not turn out the way it did before. For ships of Kittim will come against him. Kittim, coastland, same idea. Kittim referring to these regions up here all the way over to Rome. And it says, ships of Kittim will come against him. Therefore, he'll be disheartened and will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. So what did you say? Well, he's going to come down here and he gets actually within 4 miles of Alexandria when the ships from Kittim, from Rome, an ambassador named Papilius comes, an old man. And he comes and he meets Antiochus Epiphanes 4 miles short of Antiochus arriving in Alexandria. And that Livy is an ancient historian who describes this. And he says, after crossing the river at Eleusis, about 4 miles from Alexandria, he, Antiochus Epiphanes, was met by the Roman commissioners, to whom he gave a friendly greeting and held out his hand to Papilius. Papilius, however, placed in his hand the tablets on which was written the decree of the Senate. The Senate in Rome had met and had issued a decree, a message to Antiochus. And the message was, if you continue fighting against the Ptolemies, you're going to be fighting against us, the Romans. And so Papilius hands him the tablets on which that decree is written and told him, first of all, read that. Before I shake your hand, you read this. After reading it through, he, Antiochus, said he would call his friends into council and consider what he ought to do. I'll talk it over with my advisors. We'll think about this. Papilius, stern and imperious as ever,
drew a circle around the king with a stick he was carrying, drew a circle in the sand around him, and said, before you step out of that circle, give me a reply to lay before the Senate. So Antiochus said, okay, I won't find him anymore. And he went home. And that was the end of that. Well, what he did when he went back home was just what we read back there in Daniel, the 11th chapter. He turned his attention against the Holy Covenant. And he propped up those who would disobey the Holy Covenant. What he did was, he went back up here and he forbade the Jews to keep the Sabbath. He forbade them to practice circumcision, to circumcise their children. And when Jewish women would circumcise their children, it said that he would kill the babies and hang them, or kill the mothers and hang the babies around their necks. He would offer pigs, or command that pigs, swine, would be sacrificed on their altars. He would forbid them to keep the law of Moses. There was an officer of Antiochus who came to a village called Medina, and there was a priest there named Mattathias. And the officer spotted Mattathias, and Mattathias was a well-respected priest there, and he said, Mattathias, you take this offering and you do the king's offering, and if you do that, you'll be heavily rewarded in riches. And all the people will see that you're going along with Antiochus, and then everything will be cool. Mattathias said he wouldn't do it. And then there was another Israelite standing in the crowd who stepped forward and said, I'll do it. And Mattathias was so outraged by that, he killed that Jew and the king's officer. And he and his sons went off into the hills and led a revolt. And that revolt gathered steam. And now, Antiochus, he goes off to the east to concern himself with affairs over there. But he's got a general, if I recall his name was Lysias, who's trying to keep a lid on things here in the Holy Land. And he's having to fight Mattathias. Mattathias had a son named Judas Maccabee. Hence the name of the book, 1st and 2nd Maccabees. And Judas Maccabee becomes the general who's in charge. And Judas Maccabee leads the Jews in revolt against the forces of Antiochus and is successful enough that they retake Jerusalem and they retake the temple that had been defiled. And they go in and they purge the temple, they cleanse the temple, and they establish a feast, an 8-day-long feast every year to commemorate that. It's mentioned in John, the 10th chapter in the Gospel of John. It's the feast that you know as Hanukkah. John, the 10th chapter. It's in the month Kislev, and it was the 25th day of the month Kislev when they were able to cleanse the temple, which would put, Kislev would be November, December time frame. So if you go to the 25th day of the month, you're going to be into December somewhere, and that's when Hanukkah always falls, somewhere there in December. And you'll notice in John, the 10th chapter, it'll say in verse 1, it was the feast of the dedication. They rededicated the temple when they cleansed it. So it was the feast of the dedication at Jerusalem, and it was winter. John chapter 10, verse 22. And it was winter. And so there you have the mention of that. All right. Now, have you ever seen biblical prophecy in that great detail before? I'm not sure I can think of another passage in the Old Testament that predicts things in that great a detail. And as a matter of fact, this period of history, this period of time that we've been talking about right here, described by Daniel, is described in such detail that just about everybody recognizes that's what it's talking about. You can talk to an atheist scholar and he'll tell you, yeah, that's what it's talking about. You can talk to some theologian who does not believe in the resurrection of Jesus, does not believe in miracles, does not believe the Bible is inspired. And he will tell you, yes, it's obvious. You look at the history and you look at Daniel 11, and Daniel 11 is about these events. Now, some of these events that we've gone through are more certain than others. Some of them are, you're kind of thinking it's probably this, but some of them are very clear. It's hard to miss the deal with Berenice marrying the king of the north and all of that. But that brings up a question. If everybody recognizes Daniel 11 is talking about this period of time, if even people who don't believe in inspiration believe that Daniel 11 is talking about the same. You can go to Wikipedia and you can look up Antiochus III, or you can look up Antiochus Epiphanes or whatever. And as you go through there, you look up Berenice. And somewhere in that article, a lot of those articles on those various characters, it'll say, this is described in Daniel the 11th chapter. Or it'll say, many scholars, including both critical scholars and other scholars, meaning people who would be skeptical, say that this Daniel 11 is talking about this event. If they recognize that that's what it's talking about, how can they not become believers? And the answer is, they say, well, obviously, Daniel wasn't really written 600 years before Jesus. It's obviously written after these events had already occurred. And so it's somebody who's writing history but pretending it is prophecy about the future. The thing is, the scholars who say that are divided into two camps. Some of them say, obviously, Daniel, the 11th chapter, is written after the fact. But they will say it's very, very clear that there are parts of Daniel that show strong evidence of having been written 600 years before Jesus. There are things in Daniel that just don't fit somebody in the 2nd century B.C. In this short period of time before Jesus writing. There's too much detail that too accurately describes the last days of Babylon. Just one example, Belshazzar, the king who saw the handwriting on the wall. Up until the 1800s, skeptics of the Bible cited Belshazzar as an example of how Daniel didn't know what he was talking about because there was no Belshazzar in history. There was no Belshazzar who was king of Babylon. And in the 1800s, they discovered, oh, guess what? There was a guy ruling for his father while his father was away, who was kind of the last king, the last acting king of Babylon, named Belshazzar. And so, historians, Herodotus didn't mention that. Xenophon didn't mention that. Modern historians didn't know about it. But the guy who wrote Daniel knew about it. That points to a guy who lived back at that time and knew what was going on. There are other indications that Daniel, parts of Daniel, are clearly written 600 years or thereabouts before Jesus. So those scholars in that camp say, obviously, you have multiple authors of the book of Daniel. Somebody, maybe Daniel, somebody wrote early on, and then Daniel 11 was written later. And some other parts of Daniel were written later. But the other camp of unbelieving scholars say, there's clear evidence that all of Daniel was written by the same person. It just has the hallmarks of one author. It has a unity to it. And so they say the whole thing must have been written after in the 2nd century B.C., after the events we're talking about. So what you have here, they all agree, some of it had to be written after the fact, but some of them say it all had to be written by the same author, and others of them say some of it had to be written in the 6th century B.C., 600 years before Jesus. You put those two facts together, the facts based on the evidence, not facts based on presuppositions. The facts based on the evidence are that all of it was written by the same author, and that some of it was written about 600 years before Jesus. What's the logical conclusion? All of it was written 600 years before Jesus. But they say, no, that can't be because of a presupposition. And the presupposition is, how in the world could somebody have told all this stuff in detail in advance? Their presupposition is, you can't have predictive prophecy because they don't believe in that. They don't believe in inspiration. Well, there's another question that arises, and maybe it has occurred to you. Why? Why would part of the Bible become so concerned with all of this detail about what's going to happen in these years, down to swap, you know, let me give you my daughter for a wife, and so forth and so on, that doesn't really seem to have a whole lot to do with the scheme of redemption? I'll tell you what it has to do with. What's the book of Daniel ultimately about? Turn with me to Daniel chapter 2 and verse 28. This is in that chapter where Nebuchadnezzar has that dream.
about the statue and the four empires. And in that dream, before Daniel even interprets it for him, Daniel says in verse 28, "There is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. This was your dream and visions in your mind while on your bed." He tells there's a God in heaven, and he knows what's going to happen in the future, and he's told it. And then we turn over to Daniel, the fourth chapter. And this is the chapter where Nebuchadnezzar has another dream about a tree that gets cut down. He wants to know what that means. And it's basically a dream about him. He's going to be cut down if he does not submit to the God who is. We come down to Daniel's fourth chapter, verse 28-29. 12 months later, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, and the king reflected and said, "Is this not Babylon the Great, which I myself have built as a royal residence by the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty?" What mistake did he just make? He took all the credit, pride, it's all about him. He's responsible for all this. He did not acknowledge the God who allowed him to be king. And so, while the word was in the king's mouth, a voice came from heaven saying, "King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is declared sovereignty has been removed from you. You'll be driven away from mankind. Your dwelling place will be with the beasts of the field. You will be given grass to eat like cattle. And 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes." Then we come down in the chapter, and Nebuchadnezzar does spend this 7 times in an insane state of some sort. And then he comes to his senses, and his reason returns to him, and he acknowledges God in verse 34. And in verse 35, he says, "All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing. He," meaning God, "does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and no one can ward off his hand or say to him, 'What hast thou done?'" So as Daniel lays out what's going to happen, the four world empires, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, and then as Daniel chapter 11 goes into great detail about this so-called 400 years of silence, what we see is nothing surprises God. God already knows what's going to happen. And God is in control. And he will see to it that whoever he wants to rule, rules. And sometimes God puts a good man in place to rule. And sometimes, if God's will, there's a people that deserves a bad man. And God will let that happen for one reason or another. But God is in control. In the book of Daniel, you look at the book of Daniel, and a lot of the, when you read a lot of the prophets in the Old Testament, they're written especially to Jews. But the book of Daniel, it describes a man in a foreign land, the Babylonians, and then under the Persians, and his dealings with them, and his message to them. God is not just the God of the Jews. And he doesn't concern himself just with the Jews. He's the God of everybody. He's the God of all the nations. He is ultimately in control of everything. So that's our study for tonight of Daniel, the 11th chapter. It's a remarkable chapter, and probably one that you haven't looked at in detail. Maybe you have. Scott may have taken you through it. Scott has taken you through it. Let's stand and sing the song that's been announced.